Welcome to Steppin' Out, a reality radio show where you'll hear real people sharing their true stories of what it was like to go over the edge and find their way back. And now, Steppin' Out.
Welcome to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise, and we're talking to, well, you're going to hear us talking to, I should say, an incredible couple who have the most amazing story. And as you know, if you're a listener to Steppin' Out Radio, every week we just do these incredible stories of inspiration, transformation, people that have overcome all sorts of adversity in their lives. And the two people you're about to meet really do have an improbable story of survival and love, as they say on the cover of their book that they wrote. So I urge you to go get pens, pencils, and write down the name of this book, because you're really, really going to want to read it. I couldn't put it down. But anyway, I would like to welcome, they're the authors of a book called The Painting and the Piano, An Improbable Story of Survival and Love. And I'd like to welcome the authors, Adrian Lugo and John Lipscomb. John, welcome to Steppin' Out Radio.
Hi, Denise. Thank you very much for having us.
And usually on Steppin' Out Radio, we begin at the beginning of the person's story. So tell us, John, if you would, what's your story?
Okay. Well, my story starts, my name's John, and I'm an alcoholic. And I always like to start my story the day that I actually checked into detox.
Okay.
Because I never want to forget that moment in time. And then I'll go back to my childhood. But it was January 5th of 1999, which is my sobriety date. And it was one of the coldest days on record in St. Louis, Missouri. And I decided to go check to see if I was an alcoholic on a friend's recommendation and take the 20-question test. So I went into the building. It was at St. John's Hospital in St. Louis, Missouri, through the Edgewood program. And as I was going in, there was a restroom. As I walked through the doors, and I heard across from the restroom, there's a room full of a bunch of people, 30, 40, 50 people, and they were all laughing and hugging. I had no idea what they were doing in there, and it's 8 o'clock in the morning. So, and later I learned that was the AA meeting that I would start going to. But I went into the restroom, and I remember looking in the mirror and looking back at myself, and I had no idea who was staring back at me.
Wow.
I looked like I was 80 years old. My eyes were completely black. There was yellow around the whites of my eyes. You could almost call me Old Yeller.
Mm.
And I had a mound of problems. I had 3 DWIs. My wife and kids were long gone. My house was close to foreclosure. Mm. I had one car already repossessed. I hadn't filed, much less paid, my taxes for 3 years, and my life was absolutely in chaos. And so I went downstairs and took the test, and I was shaking so bad. All I remember saying is, all I want to do is just stop the shaking. I had the DTs so bad. And I couldn't really even answer the questions on the test. I couldn't use a pen, but the 20 questions, it's the first test I've gotten an A on all the way through. And so So I checked into detox on their recommendation. But I'll start back at the beginning of my story, but that's important to me because I never want to forget the day and how bad everything was.
Sure.
And how much fear I have. So I'll start back at the beginning. I was born in St. Louis, Missouri, into a pretty affluent family. And on the outside, everything looked great. You know, we were members of the right clubs, the right schools, the right people, the right this, the right that. But inside, it was complete chaos. And my mother was an alcoholic, and she passed away at age 47. But from being born until age 9, we all lived together as a family. I have a brother, and I have a sister. And I have very few recollections of my mother. And I asked my dad this in sobriety. Go, why don't I remember Mom? And he told me, he goes, well, we put her to bed most nights.
Wow.
And so you never saw her when she were home from school. And at age 9, my parents sat us all down in our living room, and this is where the piano comes in. The piano was in that living room.
Mm.
And we were sitting on the couch, and my parents told us they were getting divorced. And I kind of had knowledge of what a divorce was at age 9 because a friend of mine went through it with his parents. And so we cried, and my dad left, and we were whisked away to Florida for a vacation. And
with your mom or with your dad?
With my mom.
Okay.
And the trip was a disaster. My father told me they didn't know how we were going to get us home. The service staff at the hotel had to take my mom back home every night after dinner because she couldn't walk. Mm. And somehow we made it back home to St. Louis. And at that point, my mother was sent away to Baltimore for detox, and she ended up staying for 5 years in Baltimore, and we really did not see her for 5 years, my brother and my sister and I.
So she went, I'm sorry for interrupting, but she went to detox and then never came home? She wasn't in detox all that time.
She went to detox, and she ended up getting an apartment in Baltimore, and she was never really part of our life from age 9 until age 14.
Okay.
And she had her own life in Baltimore. We saw her once or twice during that period, but we really had no interaction with
her. Was she sober?
I'm sorry?
Was she sober? Did she get sober?
Well, we weren't living with her, so we really don't know.
Oh, okay, okay.
I would assume not once she got out of, but I don't know. I don't know. That's a good question.
Sure.
I just don't have an answer to that.
Okay.
At age 14, she came back to St. Louis, and it was kind of a strange summer because my father remarried and my mother remarried, and she had just come back to St. Louis, and that started a huge custody battle.
Oh, wow.
And it went on for months and months, and finally the judge took my brother and sister and I back into chambers and asked who we wanted to live with. And I said, I want to live with my father. And my brother and sister said the same thing, but at that time I was age 14, so he said, you're old enough to make your decision, but your brother and sister can't. And so my brother and sister were forced to live with my mother.
Oh, wow.
And I would go stay with them every other weekend at my mother's house. So mm-hmm. we'd trade back and forth, so we were together on the weekends.
Okay.
So at age 15 is really when my drinking career started. And as soon as I had my first drink, it worked very well for me.
And I'm going to ask you to back up just a tiny bit.
Please.
Was your mother sober when the kids went to live with her? And did you like your stepfather or no?
No, we didn't. My stepfather was from the Navy, and we weren't used to Navy men. And he was a pretty tough guy, and he was a big drinker. My mother was not sober.
Okay.
I remember driving with her. I remember only driving my mother two times in my life. Once when I was very young, and she left the door open, and I fell out of the car going around a turn. And the other time was when I was age 14, after she had returned to St. Louis, and we were driving to a fast food restaurant, and she got pulled over, and she got breathalyzed.
Wow.
And so she was not sober, and the scene at my mother's house was pretty horrific. Through high school, ambulances were there constantly because she would fall and she would hit her head.
Mm.
She was most of the time, to my recollection, most of the time she was passed out on the couch. Whenever I saw her. And I remember I was only there every other weekend with my brother and my sister.
Sure. And then you picked up a drink.
And my sister went away to boarding school because he couldn't handle it.
Ugh.
And my brother had to endure it all. And
you started drinking. And then you started drinking at 15.
And I started drinking at age 15 right then.
And who introduced you to it? Just your friends?
I'm sorry?
Your friends just picked it up and that was it?
Yeah, it's when we all started drinking. I obviously drank heavier than all my friends did from day one. And so I drank alcoholically once I could. But it was, you know, back in when I was in high school, it was pretty much just weekends. It wasn't, you know, a daily or a nightly thing. It was just on the weekends and pretty normal kid stuff.
And we're going to find out what happened when you started drinking. You're listening to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McIntyre, your host today. And you're listening to John Lipscomb, who wrote a book called The Painting and the Piano, An Improbable Story of Survival and Love. It's an incredible story, and you're going to hear more of it up next. And you can get the book on Amazon, Kindle, Apple, and at paintingpiano.com. And why don't you tell us what happened then?
Okay. Well, I was about 15 when I started drinking, and it was primarily on weekends. But I always drank more than my friends, and it was pretty obvious early on that I had an issue with it. Both sides of my family, I have the gene. Both sides of my family have been, you know, devastated by this disease.
Right.
And so I picked up with it, and So during high school, it kind of escalated. You know, there were car crashes, but nothing major. There weren't a lot, where we lived, there were not a lot of consequences. We lived in Ladue, Missouri, which is kind of a high-end suburb of St. Louis, and there weren't a lot of consequences back then. We got pulled over, the police would say, well, all right, Lipscomb, time to take you back home and just follow us back home. So I didn't have to go through a lot of consequences, but maybe a good thing or a bad thing, and probably a bad thing in my case.
Mm-hmm.
So I continued drinking through high school, and in college it escalated, so then I could drink on a daily basis or nightly more. And I went through five schools in college, but I finally graduated, and I moved to Texas. And in Texas, I started drinking daily every single day.
Did you work?
I was working. I started my own business. And I've always been in this business, Invisible Fences. My company, it was Invisible Fence in Texas, and then when I moved back to St. Louis, it was called Dog Watch Hidden Fences, which are underground containment fences for dogs.
Oh, cool.
And so it was always my own business from day one. I don't do well with authority.
Uh-huh.
I'm somewhat of a control freak. Imagine that for an alcoholic.
Right.
But nobody could watch over me, so I could do what I wanted to do
right from
day one. So, so I was married down in Texas. It was more of a marriage of convenience. And I decided to move back about 5 years after I started my business and bring my wife back to St. Louis with my daughter. And we moved to St. Louis in 1990. And once we moved back, I kind of fell in with my old friends and, you know, going out on the weekends and drinking. And then I had a son, and they're about 2 years apart. And once I had my son, the drinking was escalating bit by bit, and I was going out with my friends, and I got involved with a very alcoholic affair.
Mm.
And one of the saddest parts of my story is burned into my brain. I'll remember it till the day I die. Is I was leaving out of my driveway, and my 4-year-old and 2-year-old were waving to me out of the dining room window while I was going to go out and drink and have my affair.
Wow.
And it just burned into my head. And the alcohol was just too powerful. I would step on everybody and anything to get what I wanted. And I continued with that affair. Eventually, my wife had enough.
Mm-hmm.
And filed for divorce. And so I won't go through my whole divorce. That's a whole other story. But she filed divorce, and they moved back to Texas. But I continued in my alcoholic relationship, and it got worse and worse and worse. And finally, a year before I got sober, I noticed that I started drinking early in the morning. I've always been an early riser, but I would drink at 5 or 5:30 in the morning, and I had to stop the shakes.
Wow.
And to feel okay. So I would gag and beer was actually my drink of choice for the most part. So I would gag a beer down or two beers just to stop the shakes to feel okay at 5 or 5:30. I'd go to work, and then I started drinking throughout the day, putting the dog fences in. In one way or another, I get through it all, and I drank. I was a blackout drinker, so once I got home that night, I would drink until I passed out, and then I'd get up. And if you can call it a functioning alcoholic, I was somewhat of a.
Was your business succeeding?
It was brand new when I started in St. Louis. When I moved back to St. Louis, I started the dog fence business again, and it was succeeding, but slowly. It was a very slow process, and but I was able to hold on to it. But towards the end, I almost lost it. I fell so far behind in debt with the manufacturer, and they were willing to kind of string me along. But at the very end, it was close to being taken away before I got sober on January 5th.
Right.
And then about 3 weeks before I actually got sober, my birthday is December 17th, I had stopped eating, and all I was doing was drinking. And so I had my last meal when I was age 40 on December 17th. And I literally drank around the clock. I would drink for 2 hours, and then I'd pass out. And drink 2 hours and pass out, and I didn't know if it was day or night. And I remember one day I was driving. It was 9 o'clock. I go, oh, no, I'm late for my appointment. And I got in my truck. All I left was a work truck. My other car had been repossessed.
Sure.
And I was driving to go to work, and I got in the car, and I was halfway down the lane, and it's pitch black, and I have a cup of coffee in my hand. I go, it's 9 o'clock at night. It's not 9 o'clock
at night. Oh, wow.
And I lost all track of time, and I was pretty well gone. And so my dad came over about a week before I got sober, and at 8 o'clock in the morning, I'd already had a Magnum of wine, and I threw him out of the house. And then a friend who suggested I take the test to see if I was an alcoholic. I called her, and she said, if I set up the appointment, will you go? And I said I would. For some reason, at that one moment, I was open to going to see if I was an alcoholic to accept help, and I have no idea why I actually did. I think God inspired me.
Right.
So I was willing to do it, and that's when I walked into that bathroom at Edgewood, and I checked into detox.
Unbelievable.
And, from there, it's just been an amazing story. When I checked into detox, I stayed for 5 days. I was shaking like a paint can shaker at a hardware store. Without being overly dramatic, I don't know if I was hours away or a day or two away from dying, but it was pretty close.
And you're also only 40 years old at this point, too, right?
I was 40 years old. I was bloated. You know, said my eyes. You could have called me Old Yeller because my eyes were yellow.
And you said before this, John, you had like DWIs and all sorts of other things.
I had 3 DWIs after, you know, in the early days I didn't, but those accumulated. And I had 2 DWIs in the last year. And so 3 total. And so everything was a mess. It was an ugly scene. And so I went through detox, and in detox they made you go up to that meeting that I saw in the morning, the AA meeting. And I went up. And when the first day I walked in, I kind of hid in a corner, and everybody's hugging and laughing. I go, what are you guys so happy about? This is a miserable experience.
Really?
But I kept going. So I went up the next morning, and then somebody looked over at me and go, you're a Lipscomb, aren't you? And I go, yeah, how do you know? Mm. They go, well, I know your dad. And I go, okay. And then another person came up and said they knew me. But they made me feel at home and welcome. And it was the first time I ever felt comfortable in my own skin that I knew where I belonged, and this is where I belong. And after that, my life just took off in recovery. I went to outpatient as well as the AA meetings. I went to 2 or 3 meetings per day. And in 6 weeks, my outpatient counselor, and this is my burning bush, and this is why I'm sober today.
Uh-huh.
She turned to me when I was in her office, and she goes, I want you to write a letter. And I go, who to? She goes, I want you to write a letter to your mom. And I go, why am I going to write a letter to my mom? My mom died at age 47. I was 22.
Wow.
I go, why am I going to write a letter to her? And she goes, just do it. So I went home that afternoon, and it took me 2 or 3 hours, and I cried all the way through writing this letter to my mother. And I didn't realize the anger and the resentment and the hatred I had for her. And it all came out at that moment.
And we're going to find out what was in that letter, more what was in that letter. You're listening to Steppin' Out Radio. I'm Denise McIntyre, your host. You can check us out at steppinoutradio.com. Sign up for our free newsletter. And I'd like to definitely urge you to get the book, The Painting and the Piano. And I'm improbable story of survival and love. And right now we're listening to John Lipscomb, but we're also going to hear a story from Adrian Lugo, who, well, you'll hear the story. You're listening to Stepping Out. I'm Denise, where week after week we tell these amazing stories of people who have overcome all sorts of adversity and triumphed on the other side. And gosh, this man and woman we're about to speak to, Adrian Lugo and John Lipscomb, wrote a book called The Painting and the Piano. It's really an incredible story of survival and love, and you can get it on Amazon, and you can get it on their website, paintingpiano.com. And I suggest you get it. It's such a fascinating book, but it ends with hope, inspiration. It's humorous, but it's unforgettable. So, John, when we last left, a therapist urged you to write a letter to your mom, who passed away at the young age of 47 from, I'm assuming, alcoholism or the result of alcoholism. And you were angry at your mom. And what happened next?
So she asked me to write the letter, which I did. And then I was in her office, and I read it to her. And she goes, oh, I want you to read it in front of your outpatient group. And I was scared to death to read it in front of anybody, but I did. So that evening, there were about 14 people in our outpatient group, and I read the letter, and I bawled the whole way through. And right when I was done reading the story, I literally and physically felt this dark gray cloud lift off of my shoulders. And right there and then, the compulsion, desire to drink, 100% left me.
That's unbelievable.
And I haven't had a compulsion or desire to drink, and that was over 17 years ago.
That's a miracle.
And I was a daily drinker and a hard daily drinker, and it left me right then. And from then on, it's just been a magical ride. And I continued to go to a lot of meetings, and I went to outpatient for another month or two. I've sponsored a lot of people along the way. I've spoken at universities, and I've stayed very involved with AA and recovery programs in general. And I have lots and lots and lots of friends, obviously, in the program and outside of the program. And all my friends came back to me. My business took off. Everything came back to me in spades. And where my life is from where it was that January 5th, 1999, is light years to where it is today, where we're on the beach in southern Florida enjoying the winter.
And,
that's
great.
That's
okay,
kind
yeah,
of my
no,
story
thank you. Okay,
nutshell.
But we're going to get back to you. But
okay.
Now the co-author of The Painting and the Piano is Adrian Lugo. And Adrian has an unbelievable story to tell. So, Adrian, welcome. And
thank you very much for having us.
No, thanks for coming on. And just like with John, we begin at the beginning. What's the beginning of your incredible story?
Well, I always start my story at birth because I was born addicted to heroin. And I go through my childhood a little bit, So I went to my parents. My foster parents, who I consider my parents, at the age of 10 months old. I don't know where I was until then, temporary foster care.
Right.
And at the age of 5, they sat me down and told me that I had another set of parents, and they always did it in a way to make it positive, and that I had two mommies and daddies, and it was going to be great. And, I really didn't think much of it. I met them. We would take the Long Island Railroad into Manhattan, and I met them at the agency. And they brought me gifts, and that was that. And, slowly, a couple of years later, they're like, okay, well, now you have a sister. So I think I'm like 7 now. And I meet my biological sister at the agency.
Wow.
Some of, the timing is a little foggy,
sure.
But, in the book, there are trips that they make to Long Island to come visit me. I remember half the time waiting and them not showing up. So around 9 years old, they wanted me back, and my parents sat me down told me, and I said, well, of course I don't want to go back. And they said, okay, we'll fight for you. And it was a long court battle. It lasted a year. And the final decision was the judge made was based on an interview, one with me and one with my sister. And, I think it's kind of funny, clearly I was, full of fear. The judge thought my sister, I guess, now looking back, children that grow up in alcoholic homes are, very mature for their age. She was running a household at age, 11.
Right.
So the judge basically, based on my sister, she seemed so well adjusted, sent me back. And I was there for about 5 years. They were supposedly rehabilitated because they were on methadone programs. And for the most part, my biological father went to work and kept it together, but my biological mother didn't. And within a few years, things just disintegrated. And then we went and lived with a family upstate New York for a while until things were just getting bad. We were with my biological father, then my mother, and I'll never forget, we had this meeting at the agency, and my biological mother, just out of spite, would not let me go back to my parents, the Cons, and nor would she let my sister go back to Florida, where she had been raised. So there was a family upstate New York that my sister had gone to one summer, and she agreed to let us go there. And so Herb, my biological father, as we packed up the U-Haul to take us upstate New York, said, he basically predicted, he said, Elaine will be dead or in jail within a year. Mm. And 6 months later, he called, and she went to pick up her methadone, and she was jaundiced. They admitted her, and she died several days later from liver failure, and it was the happiest day of my life.
Wow.
She was very abusive, and I had such tremendous fear.
How old were you at this point, Agent?
I was 15.
Yeah, so you're so young.
I was gone for 5 years. So, I guess that year upstate New York, the family they had five kids of their own, and they took in inner city kids. And I think the mom, Lily, I think she encouraged her to let me go back after she died, because I was definitely hanging out with the wrong crowd. I started drinking, I started smoking pot.
Right.
And I think, she said to her, let her go back. And he did,
And where did you go? Back to the cons or to your death?
Back to the cons.
Oh, good.
I said to her, look, the Breens are really nice, but they're not, my parents.
Right.
And the cons are.
Mm-hmm.
And Willie Breen encouraged him, and I went back. And my mom, put her arms around me and said, my baby's home.
Wow.
And, after that, I it was still an adjustment going back to school. And I really didn't, I definitely was a budding alcoholic. I partied in high school, and even when I was upstate New York, I was already trying, I would take a pill if someone told me, LSD. I was definitely experimenting. And then, same thing through college, I did black out when I drank. But for the most part, I didn't think I was doing anything different than my friends,
right.
Sorority parties, frat parties, so on and so forth. Well, so I graduate from college, and honestly, that to me, even to this day, was my biggest achievement, because I put myself through school. It was just something that I wanted to prove to myself and everyone else, because I struggled. I guess if they did the testing they did today, they'd probably see I had a lot of learning differences.
Right, but you did it. Wow.
So I went, I actually was doing an internship at USC LA County in the mental, in the psych ward, and I was supposed to go to Europe. I didn't go to Europe because things overseas were bad. So I went to Club Med alone.
And we're going to find out what happened when you went to Club Med alone, Adrian. When we come back, you're listening to Steppin' Out. I'm speaking with Adrian Lugo, who's the co-author of this great book that we're talking about, two stories and how they intertwine, and you'll hear that in a minute. It's called The Painting and the Piano, An Improbable Story of Survival and Love. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it on their website at paintingpiano.com. You're listening to Steppin' Out. And up next, we're going to hear more of Adrian's story on Steppin' Out. And check us out at steppinoutradio.com for more stories like these. You're listening to Steppin' Out. I'm talking to Adrian Lugo, who's telling this fascinating story of her triumph over adversity. And when we left, Adrian, you said you were in college and it was important to you that you completed it, and you're happy you did. But then I'm guessing you started to develop an addiction issue?
Well, I was, I met my ex-husband, and he was a surgery resident and heart surgeon. We moved to Iowa. And, I was always cognizant of being born addicted to heroin, and had 3 C-sections, had to take, pain meds, but never, finished them. And then when I was 32 or 33, I had a really severe herniated disc. And so the pain meds thing just started, you know, and then got off them a couple of years later. I became, very dependent on it. And
what made you pick it up a couple of years later?
Well, another surgery.
Okay.
And then I had, and that surgery was not a success like the first one. And, at this point, I'm in a really bad, my marriage is bad. You know, my ex-husband was extremely controlling. What I thought initially was he was madly in love with me was really, he was just obsessive and controlling. So if I left my cell phone anywhere and I didn't answer it when he called, I was in a panic.
Wow.
We moved to St. Louis. It was sort of a geographic change, as they say, and I had another surgery, and just back up real quick, I was concerned about his drinking at some point because we were financially in a really bad shape, and he hadn't paid taxes in years, and I was in my fog and didn't know it, so I noticed he was drinking and went to Al-Anon. And so I had experience with a 12-step program. And then, really fast forward, I also have lupus, and my youngest daughter was diagnosed with an immune deficiency, a chronic illness. And between my marriage being so bad and her illness, it was enough for me. That was my bottom.
Right.
And I just called I blew the whistle on myself, and I said, if I can't take care of myself, how can I take care of Frankie? And how do I figure out how to get out of this marriage?
Right.
And so I go to treatment for 90 days. I get back, and the church right next door to me has a 7 a.m. AA meeting that meets every day. And I walk into the church, and the first person I see is John, and he's like, "You look really familiar." And I'm like, "Yeah, you put in my fence for me twice because I moved."
Right.
And
wow.
And that's how we met, and that's how it started. And about a month or two into going every day, my sponsor was going away on vacation, who I called every morning religiously. And she said, "Listen, if you can't get a hold of me, call Johnny."
That was
<he's>
helpful.
Safe.
And John,
I did, and I
we heard
him
John's
every
story,
night.
Right? Just for those out there, before Adrian's story, John told his story. So you called him every night, and is what happened?
Well, what I loved about calling him is our talks were all inspirational. Like, he would tell me about his friend Pete and where he was today, and just very positive, and it was all recovery, it was all recovery.
No, that sounds great. So, John, do you want to chime in yet, or Adrian, you want to finish up? What happened?
Whatever you think's best, Denise. What do you think?
Okay. All right, we're going to start back in three. Wait a minute. We'll have Adrian finish up. And Adrian, you said when we last left, and it was all positive.
Okay.
And then, you could finish up your sentence. And
okay.
Then we'll take it from there. Okay.
Well, we'll probably just bring up after Adrian's done, maybe one of us would bring up the parallels in this.
I'll bring it up.
Okay.
Okay.
Okay, wow, Adrian, so that sounds amazing. So you had this great conversation night after night with John.
Night after night, and, it just turned into a really close friendship. And then I had just celebrated over a year of sobriety, and my dad, who raised me, had passed away. And my brother was looking at papers, And he said, I don't know, for some reason I have your biological mother's death certificate. And I said, oh, okay. And I looked at it, and she had passed away at age 47. And I immediately called John, and I was like, "What? How old was your mom again?" And he said 47.
Wow.
And that's when we really started to see the parallels in our relationships. And
you both had moms with problems, right?
Yeah, both had moms with problems, and you know, the court cases, custody battles, and you know, and that, so our talks just grew, and we became closer and closer. And I'll let you chime in now.
Okay, John.
And then we just realized that there were so many parallels, and at some point, people started talking to us, saying, "You all should write a book."
Right.
And we go, yeah. Well, we don't have time. We're too busy. And who's going to listen to our story? And then as time progressed, you know, four or five years ago, I ended up selling my business.
Me moving in with the girls.
Adrian moved in with, Adrian has three girls, and she moved in with her three girls, which was an experience on its own. but we became very, very close. And along the way, people were saying, you all should write a book. And we decided that once I sold my business, ago, maybe we should look into actually writing this book. And we already had the name, The Painting and the Piano. The piano was my mom's, and the painting was Adrian's mother's. They both play a very significant role in the book.
Right.
And so we had the name, and we go, well, let's look into it. And we honestly didn't know a thing about writing a book. So we just started on day one, just reaching out and asking people for help, as we did in AA and other programs. And bit by bit, we got there, and we think we've produced a really good, high-quality book that's a tandem parallel.
Yeah, and it could almost be like a movie, the way it, you know, the way it flows. And, you know,
and we've heard that a lot, and we actually have somebody maybe working on that right now.
Yeah, good. That's what everybody says.
I think so, yeah. And it's called The Painting and the Piano, for those of you who want to get it. Go to Amazon right now. And it's written by John Lipscomb and Adrian Lugo, and it's called The Painting and the Piano. And you can go to their website if you want to give it out. John, go ahead.
It's www.paintingpiano.com, and that's our website, and you can order the book from there. There are a couple chapters you can read for free under Buy This Book section, and there are newspaper articles. Adrian's custody case when she was little was carried nationwide by the press.
Right.
And so there are a lot of articles in there as well.
Yeah. So, right. So the fact that you both, you know, and having mothers with problems, you know, it's a lot harder from what I hear from people than even if it's your dad or, you know, your mother. It's a real hard one, you know. But what happened next? So you wrote this book, and now you're, you know, being interviewed on radio shows, and I'm sure television and cable. But, like, what is next for you, or what's your life like now? Do you want to do more books? What's your life like now?
Well, we would love to if this is successful, but I really, you know, want to focus on this right now and use this as a platform so that we can really help other people, because that's what got me through, is just that hope and inspiration. Particularly when I first got sober, I wanted to read everything I could, and so we're really hoping that this will turn into a platform where we can go around and speak and inspire and encourage other people.
Well, I think both of you too, you know, not only did you survive your own issues with addiction or substances, you also survived your childhood. And I forget the statistic, but like one in four or something, or five children grow up in a household with one or more parents who were addicted, right?
Right, and, you know, the way our book starts off is my father was in a bad car accident in the prologue, and I was talking to my stepsister when we were there at the time, and her father is a noted psychiatrist in Houston, and she asked him one day, you know, how do you sum up psychiatry, and how do you help people in one sentence? And he said, if I know the relationship a child has with his or her mother, then I can help that person.
I read that in your book, and I got the chills, because that's so on point.
It and everybody we talk to, it always goes back to that. It's almost scary.
Yeah. And it's probably the most important relationship, and it's interesting, but you're the first one I've you know, heard say that, and I think we all should, you know, examine that. Well, you two have told this unbelievable story. I thank you so much for coming on. And again, I want to give out the painting and the piano, an improbable story of survival and love. And if you want to get in touch with John and Adrian, you can do that on their website. I'm sure there's a contact us.
Yep.
And it's paintingpiano.com. And I can't thank you enough. And continued success, and thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much, Denise.
Well,
I really
you.
Appreciate it.
You're listening to Steppin' Out, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.